The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
Master Dungshan's five ranks of relative and absolute. The fourth rank, arrival at mutual integration. When two blades cross points, there is no need to withdraw. The one who holds the great sword is like the lotus blooming in the fire. Such a person has in and of himself a heaven-soaring spirit. Good morning. Good morning to all of you who are in the place where you are. So the last couple of talks, I've been drawing upon these five ranks, and I mentioned earlier that this is a teaching, Master Dungshan, very important teacher in our lineage, beginning of the Zaodong school, the Soto school, our lineage. He lived for most of the 9th century in China. And as I mentioned earlier, during a period of great turbulence, there was a great purge by the Emperor Wu, another Emperor Wu, not the supporter of Buddhism, but a later emperor who seems to have had it with the Buddhist monastics and was returning them to lay life and was seizing objects from monasteries and generally creating a lot of havoc. And I mention that because, you know, just to consider how this Dharma has weathered through all kinds of times and social climates of support and lack of support and has continued all this time. I was listening to a historian give a lecture recently, historian of the Civil War and Reconstruction, that period of time in our history. And she said she's often asked if there has been times more difficult than now in our country. And she says, oh, yes. And she said she actually takes some comfort in that, knowing that this country has been through very difficult, if not worse times, and has come through them. Has survived, at least. So these five ranks are, as I've been mentioning, are essentially taking up the question of how do we live in this world? In the world of things and people and situations and time and histories and memories and opinions, beliefs, governments, doctrines, all of the things that we create. All of the ways we understand and describe and define our world, and all the ways in which those come into conflict within ourselves and with each other. And what makes this a profound question from the point of view of Buddha Dharma is that that question is being of necessity brings us to the question of what is the fundamental nature of things. We see all of these things happening. Is that all there is? Is it just things happening? Is it just a world filled with an infinite number of separate beings, separate bodies, distinct from each other, essentially duking it out? Or is there some underlying, fundamental, unifying basis? And of course, the Buddha realized there is, and it is your nature, and it is the nature of everything, of every opinion, of every thought, of every time and place, of every object. And that in that fundamental nature, there is no conflict, there is no division, there is no basis for division. It's not even a place of peace. because it is not possible for there to be a lack of peace. It is free of all of that. And that's our mind. That's our nature. And so, of course, Buddhism has a tremendous amount of a body of teachings about, okay, well then how do things get all messed up? If Buddha nature pervades the whole universe existing right here and now, then like what's the problem, right? And so there is deep and thorough examination and understanding of that. And that's what we study, most directly by studying our mind and the minds of others. And in that, we study the body, we study energy, we study emotions, we study history, we study memories, we study the whole thing as it appears in one moment after the next. And by study, we bring a right understanding. We begin with a basic understanding of what the Buddha taught, and then we examine that to see, is that what you find when you look? And when you examine, not only what do you see, what do you understand, but what does that do to the whole system? And so when we see and examine intellectually, conceptually, it has a certain influence. But when we look beyond our knowing mind, when we look directly and experience directly, beyond knowing, when we come into contact with that fundamental nature, our nature, and it's not an act of will, it's not something that you have done, it's touching the center of the universe. And then you see how that transforms your mind, your way of seeing things, your way of relating to this world of objects. And so this series of teachings, which is one way of speaking about this among many. This morning we chanted the identity of relative and absolute, which is a poem, a teaching poem in our tradition, which is speaking to exactly that. What this teaching of Dungshan's does, which is so good and powerful, is that it really presents these different perspectives. So from the perspective of the absolute basis, and then the second stage, the perspective of seeing that absolute basis, that emptiness within phenomena. And then I spoke yesterday about coming from within the real, how that begins to move forward into the world, into differentiation, into objects, into all of that stuff that we thought was the obstacle. And all of this is moving towards this, the arrival at mutual integration, harmonizing, realizing that there are not two, that absolute and relative are just two, a way of speaking about our own experience of what we perceive as two aspects of what is fundamentally undivided. When two blades cross points, there's no need to withdraw. Form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. All dualities return to the one. The great ocean. The limitless sky. The Buddha said all conditioned existence is dukkha. Everything that is brought into being has the capacity to create suffering within us because we attach, we grasp, we reject, we argue, we divide. And that in that is the source of all of our pain and confusion. When we realize that all of that, every part of it, every aspect, is empty because it's conditioned, because it has been brought together as a result of causes and effects, that nothing exists by itself. Coming into being means by its very nature, it is impermanent. It is unsustainable in any state of permanence. It cannot sustain itself. Even a thought that happens where we have a stream of a thought where we're thinking about something, we may perceive as a thought, But actually, it's just a moment of instantaneous thought energies that arise and arise and arise and arise. And there's a sameness to each of those moments of thought energy arising that we perceive as a continuity, which allows us to have a thought and convey it. But there is no permanence. There is no actual continuity in that other than the sense that our consciousness creates. And so what are the implications of that when we perceive the world and ourselves and others and problems and everything as having inherent qualities, characteristics, power, the power to be good, the power to be bad, the power to help, the power to hurt, the power to be something that does something to this? Why is this happening to me? Why, based in a self, we will naturally and inevitably take things personally, right? Right? Because they're happening to us. They're happening to you. They're happening to me. You feel them. And so it's inevitable that we'll, or easy, right, to have the experience that this is happening to me. Why is this happening to me? And that sort of personalizing, in one sense, is the basis of our suffering, but it also got us here, right? It can be useful to motivate. So how do we realize the mutual integration? Because it's only there, living non-duality in thought, speech, in action, in body, in emotion, can there be true peace. And that can seem like a very, like, how do I be non-dual? How do I create non-duality in every thought, in every, well, of course you can't. In a way, it's like the old teaching, you know, that seeing that the world is filled with thorns, you can try and cover the world with leather, or you can just put on shoes. Well, in the same similar vein, right, we can think of how do I try and, you know, realize non-duality in all of these separate things, or rather just realize that there is no separateness. And then it's everywhere. When two blades cross points, there's no need to withdraw. It could be blades, it could be sticks, it could be words, it could be a look, to intentions, to opinions, to beliefs, heaven and hell, right and wrong, just and unjust, rich and poor. The swords are not in disagreement. The swords have no gripe. They're just swords. The Buddha said, I do not quarrel with the world. I do not bring conflict into the world. The world may bring conflict to me, but I do not bring conflict in the world. What a wonderful aspiration. What a wonderful vow. The world may quarrel with me, but my vow is to not bring conflict into the world. At the same time, as John Lewis said, there's good trouble. There is bringing disruption to cycles and systems that need to be interrupted. There's no need to withdraw, to defend, to protect. You know, to think about, I was listening to a talk by Doris Godwin Kearns, who wrote Team of Rivals, a book about Lincoln and his presidency, and she also recently wrote a book on leadership, talking about the presence of Lincoln, Theodore, Franklin Roosevelt, and LBJ. And they were talking, the interviewer was asking her about empathy because she was highlighting each of these four presidents who obviously were human beings and flawed, but who were very, she feels, were very good as presidents and did a lot of good. And she was talking about empathy. And is empathy something that we're just born with, or is it learned? And she talked about each of these presidents as being examples of how it's both. That for some of these just seem to be born into the world with a natural kind of empathy, and others had to learn it. And I was thinking of you know, our past administration, Trump, and our current administration, Biden, and that both of these people experienced loss in their life. But that doesn't automatically bring forth empathy, as we see. That in order for that to happen, that loss, that pain has to get in. Right? We have to actually allow it in. We have to suffer and learn how to bear that suffering. And part of what can come out of that, can come out of that, doesn't necessarily, but can come out of that, is a profound sense of compassion, of sympathy, of empathy. Because having experienced that suffering and that loss in whatever form it comes in, we see that in other people, we understand it on some level. Whereas if we haven't let it in, and that from a Buddhist perspective, that natural capacity for empathy and sympathy, I think we can really understand as being based in our fundamental nature. That we have a natural inclination to that, unless it is so suppressed or becomes so confused that it doesn't come forth. In the Mahaparinirvana Sutra, the Mahayana Mahaparinirvana Sutra, there's a Mahaparinirvana Sutra that is the Buddha's, about the Buddha's end of life. But in this Mahayana Sutra, it says, the Buddha's disciples deeply cherished the thought of liberating such opposites as sorrow versus bliss, the eternal versus the non-eternal, pure versus impure, self versus no self, real versus not real, being versus non-being, peace versus no peace, the created versus the non-created, disruption versus non-disruption. That the bodhisattva deeply yearns to bring forth the thought, the aspiration, to be liberated from such opposites, the dualities, the two blades crossing point. Hakuin about this rank, mutual integration, where all of those opposites that we've lived our whole life in and we've been tossed back from one side to the other, from joy to sadness, from tension to release, from holding on to letting go, from right to wrong. More and more now they're becoming integrated. Not because we're merging them, like mixing hot chocolate and water and milk and having them become something new, but rather because we're realizing there never was a difference. There was no separation. There was no distinction. The two blades do not argue with each other, right? The holders of those blades may have an argument. Hakuin about this rank says, in this rank, the bodhisattva of indomitable spirit, right? And that's a way of, like that's us, right? That in the face of great suffering, an indomitable spirit, in other words, a spirit that perseveres, that has faith, that continues, that takes another step, that breathes another breath, and then exhales, and then begins again. An incredible thing. In the face of such suffering, to be able to continue. Not blindly, not madly, but with wisdom. The bodhisattva of indomitable spirit turns the dharma wheel of the non-duality of brightness and darkness, relative and absolute. They stand in the midst of the dust of the world. Their head is covered with dust and their faces are streaked with dirt. In other words, they're in it. Right? They're not standing apart or on high. They move through the confusion of sound and sensual pleasure, buffeted this way and that. They're not unaffected. They're not impervious. Indomitability doesn't mean impervious. That's their indomitable spirit, being affected. You know, I was saying to somebody earlier that when we take on a role, a parent, a teacher, an administrator, a construction site manager, any role in which you take on a responsibility that influences other people, and there's a sort of an added responsibility that in a sense increases the potential for effect, but also increases the potential to cause harm. And that responsibility, the burden of that, is from a bodhisattva point of view, the generosity of being in that role. That person is taking on that burden because it gives them the opportunity to serve and puts them in a position of some influence in which to do just that, and knows that in doing that, that there will be a kind of a weight to that. Right? And in a sense, that person takes that on so that other people hopefully can move more freely, can be free to do more of what they need to do. So somebody takes that on for them, for those people, and for the larger purpose. And to do that knowingly, consciously, freely. Hakuin says they're like the fire-blooming lotus that, on encountering the flames, becomes even brighter in color and pure in fragrance. That rather than being beaten down and sort of diminished, it's like we learn how to thrive, learn how to flourish, which is no small thing. They enter the market with empty hands, empty all over, and yet others receive their benefit. This is called being on the road, yet not having left the mountain. To have left the mountain, but yet not to be on the road. Non-abiding. Are they an ordinary person? Are they a sage? The evil ones and the heretics can't discern, don't know, are confused. Even the Buddhas and ancestors can't lay their hands upon them. Were anyone to try and indicate their mind, it would be no more than like the horns of a rabbit or the hairs of a tortoise, which don't exist, that have gone beyond the farthest mountain. So he's basically praising and saying that this, in this stage of mutual integration, as Dogen, I quoted Dogen yesterday, who said, more and more we leave no traces of consciousness. In other words, we don't leave a residue, a trail behind us. A couple weeks ago, Jimon and I were on vacation. We were up in the Finger Lakes, and we were kayaking, canoeing on one of the Finger Lakes. And it was beautiful, and a storm was coming up. We were trying to stay on the lake as long as we could. And while the storm was coming up, wind was blowing, and it was wonderful. And there was one boat with a ski rope tied to an inner tube with a child hanging onto the inner tube. The only boat on the lake. Like a mosquito, right? Just going in circles and back and forth, going in circles, going in circles, going in circles. And I looked at the wave patterns, and it was chaos, right? You couldn't tell where usually when a boat comes through, it just cuts a wake, and the waves move apart, and they sort of move towards the ocean, towards the shore, and then they create waves, but then this was just like, ah, and I thought, yeah, it's like that. It's just like that. This mind. Running in circles, waves everywhere. It's like, oh my God. So we're trying to straighten it out a little bit. The lotus in the fire burns even brighter in the flames. That we are, you know, I think a reasonable metaphor is to think of us as, because we are evolving creatures, all things evolve to their circumstances, their conditions. We do that. And as practitioners, we are doing that not only knowingly, but post haste, right? With urgency. Not just allowing the conditions, the waves, to sort of bump up against us and hope that it, you know, brings us to shore somehow, sometime, before the storm, full storm hits, but actually we do it knowingly and try and precipitate, bring this about for others, wanting that to be our offering. And so he's describing this bodhisattva who's no longer looking for affirmation from others, no longer collapses by negation or criticism from others. In other words, they have reclaimed their mind. They are alert, they are attentive, they are constantly evolving, so they're interested in everything that reflects back. But you are reclaiming your own mind. There's a kind of, as a practitioner, there's a kind of independence of standing on your own two feet, of knowing what your path is. And when it's the Buddha Dharma path, then it is in alignment with that, and that's powerful. And so that within all of those crossing waves, those crossing blades, more and more there's a sense of clarity and discernment about what is the heart of the matter here? What is actually important? Where do I need to bring my attention? How can I be most effective? What is the question that needs to be asked? I think of that so often in terms of the koans, how there's a whole thing, there's a whole mess that's presented to the student. A dialogue, a situation, a question, an answer, a confusion, a clarity, different people. And the koan doesn't tell you this person is clear, this person's lying, this is the right, this is wrong, this is delusion. It just presents a mess. And then the student, the role of the student is to see right through that. Just like walking into a room of confusion. And not knowing all the details, not projecting, not conjecturing, not interpreting what you think people's intention is. Just sort of working directly with what the reality that you see in front of you, but knowing the nature of mind, understanding karma, and so being able to see beneath the surface that is not conjecture, but is just understanding the way things work, and then being able to more and more see into the heart of things in accordance with each dharma. The root gives rise to separate leaves. Root and branch must return to the great reality. The roots give birth to trunk and branches and stems and flowers and leaves. That's naturally so, but they're never apart from that great reality. We call it dharmata, we call it Buddha nature, we call it emptiness, we call it the vast, boundless sky. These swords, these opposites. Yunmen says medicine and sickness heal each other. All the world is medicine. How do you heal yourself? What does that mean? That in one grain of sand is the whole universe, that in one instant is it vast eons of time, that in one side is the whole. Each contains the other. When we look and we try to grasp it, we cannot find that place of their abiding. There is no place of their abiding. That is the great reality. That's what liberates us. It's not about exchanging one place for another, the wrong place for the right place. The wrong time for the right time. The wrong person for the better person. Those are the two swords. The Buddha basically realized everything is here. Everything that is needed is present. Everyone has a role. Everyone has a function. There is a koan that says, what is the body of the wind? What is the nature of the wind? Now, what is the function of the wind? Like two arrows meeting in midair. What a wonderful image. Right? Two arrows meeting. It's impossible. What kind of perfect union is that? Well, ask the person sitting on your cushion, what kind of perfect union is that? Because it's right there. Two arrows meeting, two swords crossing, no need to withdraw. And isn't that exactly how we practice? Right? That even when we step back, it's not a withdrawal. That when you enter and you try and address a situation or help someone, and what you see is, this is not helping. This is not helping. And so you step back, that is not a withdrawal. It's skillful means. It's patience. It's further reflection. It's getting more information. It's waiting for some time to pass and see how things evolve. It can be many things. Withdrawal is something that happens in our mind. In that Kearns interview, the interviewer said, at what point in each of these leaders, and essentially any leader's, any person's life, did they get that this life, their life, that life that they lived was the life they were to live? And she said, in every case, it was in the moment when they realized that their life was about something larger. That's the thread. That's when we begin to know what our life is about. So we practice, we enter into training, we devote. If we want to see this all the way through, we devote our lives. It's a path. It has no end, by the way, just in case you didn't get that memo. It has no end. Zazen is not a technique that you perfect and then move on from. It is life. It is breathing. It is living. It is endlessly revealing. It is endlessly endless. And so after so many miles, having taken so many steps, it says in the ninth Oxhurting picture, to have been taken returning to the root and the source, better to have been blind and deaf from the beginning. Dwelling in one's true abode, unconcerned within and without, the river flows tranquilly on and the flowers are red. Finally, the flowers are simply red. And you know. From the beginning, everything has been so. The clouds of our doubt and our insecurity and all of our universal human qualities and traits based on a self and a kind of a shared deception, a shared delusion. This unconcern is no longer trying to control. That's what it doesn't mean not caring. It never means not caring. It means not trying to control, no longer trying to dominate, to achieve, to fix what's broken, to win. Within every endeavor, with every effort, we apply ourselves wholeheartedly simply to bring benefit to the world, simply to see again and perhaps reveal for another that the flower is red, that the river flows. Hakuin says, still, you must not consider this state to be your final resting place. Therefore, it's said that such a person has in and of themselves a heaven-soaring spirit. What must you do? You must know that there is one more rank, the rank of unity attained. And this rank says, who dares to equal this one? Who falls into neither being nor non-being? All people want to leave the current of ordinary life, but this one, after all, comes back to sit amidst the coals and the ashes. There are other teachings that relate these two aspects, identity, absolute and relative. There's the fourfold Dharma Dhatu, for instance, another teaching. What's so wonderful about this teaching is this fifth rank. How is this different than the fourth rank? What is more is there than mutual integration? What is the subtle difference with unity attained? Here, there's no more shine, no more radiance, no more brilliance. As the heart of the Bodhisattva is to go where the confusion and pain are amidst the coals and the ashes, is it a sage? Is it an ordinary being? You know, one of the qualities of a great enlightened being is that they can walk into a room and completely fill the space, like the sun. Or they can walk into the room and be invisible. No one sees them. You don't notice. There's no trace of consciousness. And to think of that path, this path, as Dogen said, this path of letting go, of non-accumulation, and just think of, as you continue on, year after year, more and more deeply of not accumulating, of simplifying your mind, your being. Just, the flowers are red. It's Sunday morning. There's a meal to prepare. There's a house to open. There's a breath to turn to. There's a cry to respond to. Flowing like the river. The river doesn't know it's going to the ocean. And yet it can only move in that direction. Simple, uncontrived, plain like water. Living long, living short, just using this day for what it can be. And wanting everyone to have the opportunity to use this day for what it can be for them. That's why we have to work to liberate ourselves from racism, from all forms of bias, from the great burden of our earth and our own constructed destruction, so that every living thing can assume its own Dharma state, can cover the ground upon which it stands, can completely fulfill its virtue. And that is very unlikely to happen within the constraints, not just of our own delusion, but of our othering our delusion onto others, imposing our delusion onto others. That's the vow of the Bodhisattva. That's the great wish. That's the love. And so in the 10th Oxarian picture, it says, barefooted and naked abreast, I mingle with people of the world. My clothes are ragged, dust laden. You've been around the block, right? Right? At the end of Sesshin, right? You've been through a bit, right? There's some dirt on your face, right? Some bruises here and there, right? There have been some scuffles. And yet, I am ever blissful. I am joyful. I have faith. I wish to be no other place. I wish to be no other person. I choose this time. Now, I use no magic to extend my life. Before me, the dead trees become alive. I tussled with that for many, many years. What is he talking about? The dead trees come alive. Metaphor, poetry, it's not. It's true. We see into the aliveness and we realize the aliveness is everywhere. It's present within all of reality. That's what we're trying to liberate. All that was seen as inert or dead or lifeless or unworthy of our attention, now we see as coming alive, great radiance. When Dongshan, I want to finish with Dongshan's death because it's appropriate. How does a master who lived for so many years, over 40 years in the Dharma, because he died pretty young. How does a master of non-duality die? So when he was getting ready to die, he called his students together and said, and one of the monks asked, said, although the monk is unwell, the master Dongshan, is there anyone who is not sick? There's someone who is sick. Is there anyone who is not sick? Two arrows cross. What happens next? Dongshan says, there is someone who is not sick. The monk says, will the one who is not sick treat the one who is sick? And the master says, I am entitled to see this one. And then the student says, I wonder how he will be seen. And Dongshan said, when I see him, there is no one who is sick. When we meet, there is no illness. There is no need to withdraw. And then the master having summoned everyone, said, it's time for me to die. And so it's in the records, it says he shaved his head, bathed, put on his robes, struck the bell, called everyone together, and announced his departure. And he sat in Zazen and began to pass away. And there are many accounts of this happening. So to think of being so attuned to one's inner and outer being, to one's life force, to one's energy, to one's mind, and to be so at peace that this is the time, and to begin to pass away. And as he began to pass away, the Sangha began to wail and lament, cry out in grief. And it says this continued for some time without stopping. And then eventually Dongshan opened his eyes and looked around and said, for those who have left home, a mind unattached to things is true practice. People struggle to live and make much of death, but what's the use of all of this? Right? It's like, remember. And he said, but anyway. And he ordered for arrangements to be made for a delusion banquet. I mean, can you just imagine? I mean, what a... You just got to love this person, right? It's like he's ready to go, and it's like the Sangha won't let him go. And he's like, okay, all right, let's have a banquet. And it says this: the Sangha's feeling of bereavement did not go away, that the preparations for the banquet just kept getting extended. Which is sort of, is like, did they just keep making the banquet bigger and bigger, but like not having it? And it says, the master Dongshan joined in with the assembly and helped to complete the preparations. And then finally said, okay, you've made a great commotion over nothing. Now, when you see me pass away, don't make a fuss. Okay? We've done this thing. Now, it's time. And he retired to his room, perhaps closed the door, sat correctly and passed away. I was remembering when Dada Roshi, some of us were meeting over at the Abbasi years ago, and we were talking about his passing away. And we started asking him questions, you know, about how did he want us to handle that? And he said, you do that, right? You figure it out. He said, but just don't make it too big. Basically said, don't make a fuss. To die the way one has lived, to die teaching the Dharma. This that's happening, this is just the natural order of things. Let's not make a fuss about it. Let's just use it to see and to see more clearly and to help each other. So in his death, he used his last breath as an offering. The indomitable spirit of a bodhisattva. And so hearing such stories, right? These stories are passed down to us to be inspired and to aspire from our own place, in our own lives, in our own ways, small though they may seem, to bring this forward, to bring the dead trees alive, using no magic, just what you have at hand, which is abundant. So thank you for this session, for joining us this morning. We're now going to finish here and head over to the Jizo House for the opening. So please come along and we'll meet you over there.
Thanks for listening. Looking for in-person practice opportunities? With the easing of pandemic quarantine restrictions, Zen Mountain Monastery and the Zen Center of New York City are once again open for group meditation, services, residency, and retreats. We'll continue to offer online programs to our Sangha near and far, even while we host more in-person events for all those able to travel. You can find all upcoming activities listed on our website, zmm.org.